saying how much they want a strong woman. What they really want is a cheerleader.
I'd like someone who's physically very frail and won't stop talking.
I just want what everybody wants. I just seem to have a harder time getting it.
All right, you are here, and here is Maximum Film, episode 328. Also here with me is my beloved, my Santa-y looking, my one of my favorite film critics, but definitely not the best favorite because of today. However, he's right up there, Alonzo Giraldi. What's good?
Well, Drea Clark, who's hosting this week.
I forgot to say that part. Listen, I knew who I was.
And that's one of the things I love about you, is that you are very self-possessed. You don't need the rest of the world to know. You know, and that's all that matters.
Exactly.
What's good with me is that over the past weekend, which will be the weekend prior to when this episode drops, both Die Hard and Love Actually reopened theatrically in an official capacity, not like just little one-off shows here and there or Fathom events, but actually came back to theaters, and both of them opened in the top 20. And so I find this really exciting, and I hope that it encourages studios to do more reissues, not just at Christmas time, but any time during the year when there's a weekend that they perceive to be kind of a slow one, which is the rap about the early weekends of December, that people are doing other stuff, yada, yada. I mean, to put on my grandpa cardigan for a moment, I grew up in the era before cable and VCRs and all that stuff, and people used to reissue movies all the time. Mm-hmm. Like every couple of years, Sound of Music would be back in theaters, Jaws would be back in theaters, like Gone with the Wind would be back in theaters, whatever. You know, I remember when I lived in Dallas, like, you know, there'd be these week-long runs of like Dr. Zhivago or Giant, you know, and you get to see them on the big screen. And so I think people would show up for this stuff. You know, I mean, yes, we have it all the touch of a button and blah, 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 but there is something about that experience of going back into the movie theater that's so special that we all revere. And so the fact that both Die Hard and Love Actually had these pretty good weekends with very little hype and, you know, probably didn't cost that much money for, you know, for their owners to make them available again. It's not like they had to strike new prints or anything. I hope this is a trend that we see more of.
I agree. I hope we see more of it. And I hope it's more films that won't be in the vein of the people who love to talk about how Die Hard's a Christmas movie. Also show actual Christmas movies back in the theater. But yeah, I'm with you. And for anyone who was thrown by Alonso's comment that perhaps he's not wearing a grandpa cardigan all the time, just know I picture him that way whether he is or not. And you are welcome to as well.
It's a spiritual thing. Yes, it's never not there, I guess.
Yes, it's a spiritual cardigan. All right, so as I clumsily alluded, we are graced with the presence of another fantastic film critic today. She is also the co-host of Breakfast All Day, best eyebrows in the game, Christy Lemire. What's good?
Woo-hoo. Hi, happy to see you guys. Thank you for asking me on here. I have to be totally honest, if you guys are listening to this, the eyebrows to which Drea alludes are not entirely mine. When you turn 50, guys, things happen to your body, and you get hair in places, and you lose hair in others. And so these eyebrows are not ones I was born with. Just pull them back the curtain.
To paraphrase Dolly Parton, you bought them, they're yours.
Nice. It's Christy's eyebrows are her grandpa cardigan.
You know, I love it. It's like a little wand. It's a wand, and I wash it off. Anyway, peel it back the curtain here. What's good are Christmas cookies. They're everywhere, you guys. And this time of year, I have a total weakness for Christmas cookies. They're so pretty, and invariably, they taste as good as they look. And I try really hard to be healthy. As Alonzo can attest, I'm super annoying talking about running. I'm training for the LA Marathon again. I'm super, runners are so boring, you guys, like the biggest narcissist, like so boring talking about shoes and injuries. But I feel like I'm okay consuming Christmas cookies to my heart's content. Also because I'm in my 50s now, so who cares? Because I
nobody
can run it
said,
all off.
Nobody said carbo loading couldn't be shaped like a snowman.
That's true. It can be festive and it can be fuel. So so that is what is good. And they're just everywhere. And we had our LA film critics voting meeting this weekend. And there were cookies there. And there are here a cookie, there a cookie, everywhere a cookie. And I'm okay with it. It's December 11th today. But I think it's okay the whole month long.
Yeah. Oh yeah, look, show me that whatever Pepperidge Farm variety pack has like a red ribbon on it. I'm sold. I'll take it. It's all give me all of it. Drea, my darling, what is good?
Oh, I'm so glad. Mine is in the world of Christie's in terms of, oh, as an aging human in this world who is approaching perimenopause. And that means somehow, you know how the internet knows everything about you now and there's just no escaping it? And like, I'll mention something as random as like, oh yeah, South African football. I don't even know if that's a thing, but anyone listening is now going to get 12 ads for it. So the kind of ads I get are all like, oh, are you an aging woman in this world? And the ads I respond to are the ones like, yes. Am I interested in magnesium glycinate? I am. And what's good for me is magnesium glycinate because it's one of those things that I 100% had like come up as is recommended articles or whatever. I'm like, yeah, I'll give it a go. Magnesium. That sounds like something I recognize from the before times. And I'm telling you, it helps with sleep. It's a calming thing. All of this, it may surprise people who listen to this. I'm not actually trained in medicine or anything related to the sciences. So take your magnesium glycinate with a grain of salt. But I very much enjoy it. It's working for me. It could be a placebo, but anything that makes me feel in charge of myself and my destiny, you know, is all I want in this world.
I yeah. like the idea that like the new prank is going to be getting your friend's phone and just saying random phrases in it, like ladybug galoshes, you know, and just seeing what happens.
It's so true. It's so the future we're living in. And strangely, that future is not as wild as what we're going to be talking about in Yorgos Lanthimos' new film, Poor Things. Which is what we'll be talking about today. We're also going to be pitching some reimagined monster movies. But first, it's time for It a Dick, which is our movie news segment where we talk about the latest and greatest news that's come up in the movie world. And it stands for, is this important? Do I care? A question you can ask yourself about almost anything. But in this instance, we're just going to be talking about that question as relating to movies. So,
well, pop the pink champagne. The Golden Globe nominees were just announced, and Greta Gerwig, who was somehow passed over for directing nominations for both Lady Bird and Little Women, now finally has a Best Director nomination for Barbie. No women were nominated for Best Director in 22. Gerwig has been nominated twice before for Best Actress with Frances Ha and Best Screenplay with Lady Bird. Is this important? Do you care?
No. Because the Golden Globes aren't important. And I think it's hilarious to suggest that all of a sudden, poof, they are. Like, okay, they're bigger now. It's a bigger group. And there are 300 of them and they're more diverse. And they're picking cool things like The Zone of Interest, you know. And it's not just like, hey, let's get the latest Angelina Jolie movie in there. Because so Angelina Jolie will show up and she'll like do the leg on the red carpet. Like, it's too soon. We don't know. We just don't know. I mean, not so long ago, they were all like hacks on the take, right? People just going to receptions, going to luncheon.
Hacks on the take.
Right? And so now we just don't know. So they're picking things like Celine's Song was nominated. We have serious movies that are serious contenders for other awards. Movies that, Alonzo, you and I talked about yesterday at voting. But yes. I just think it's too soon to assume that they are like a legitimate organization.
Yeah, I don't know what we're supposed to do with a Golden Globes that isn't a joke. Like, I don't know how we're supposed to wrap our minds around that. It's like when I was watching a Hallmark movie this year that was actually good, and Dave White was like, I don't understand what's happening here. My entire worldview is being rocked by this. So, if anything, I think they're just going to find themselves being another critics group. And I hate to break it to y'all, but we get ignored.
Yeah, I'll say as someone, I don't know if Christy knows this fun fact, because I worked for the Golden Globes for 11 Ooh. Years.
Oh, sorry.
Girl, no. No. I lead their ridiculous charge. You're totally fine. The idea of them getting, respectable after I leave, oh, fine, do it now. But I'll say they are still ridiculous for many reasons, one of which is that, you know, that just so they can nod to more things and get more Angelina Jolie single leg presentation on the red carpet. How they divide their drama and comedy will always be a hilarious misadventure. Oh, yeah. Like, I just, I worked in the creation of video packages, the nominee, like, and the nominees are, and having to make a comedy cut of The Martian for that. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, those things are always going to be silly. And which they are this year, because I don't remember them, but I feel like Poor Things is in there as a comedy.
It certainly, I laughed. Poor Things is very funny.
Sure. Is very funny. But I think
two actual,
like,
musicals were not nominated for Best Comedy or Musical, right, however.
But, like, Saltburn also has comedy and is in drama. Like, there's all sorts of things. You could make the same argument for many films. So it's always going to be a little weird. We'll see how it ends up.
May December is not a comedy.
That's the one I'm talking. Yeah, May December is nominated in comedy, and that's the one that I'm like, have fun making that package. Like, I don't know how many times you can do the hot dog clip in one package, but there you go.
Out of context, maybe. It makes no sense.
Yes. Or Julianne Moore saying S-H-I-T, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. I'll say, good for Greta Gerwig. Yes. If people are going to be in this fool's race, then good for them. Get whatever you can. I do think Barbie is a tremendous accomplishment as a director. And if you're going to put a bunch of dudes in there for big stuff and be like, oh, look how big it is. He did so much because it's so big. Barbie's big as hell. So good for you, Greta.
And hey, speaking of movies and speaking of places that Drea works, Spirit Award nominations were announced last week. Last Tuesday, Joel Kim Booster and Natalie Morales announced the nominees for 2023's Film Independent Spirit Awards. The ceremony will air on February 25th of 2024 and will be hosted by Adi Bryant. The ceremony honors both television and film. Movies have to have a budget of $30 million or less to be considered. And we have some behind-the-scenes tea, I imagine, from this week's fill-in host. So I guess the big question is this important? Do you care?
It is. I this is the most important. I'm sure many people will agree. I'll say in Alonzo and Christy, are people familiar with Film Independent and how things are done in general there? Film Independent has a very earnest and beloved mission, which is really looking at both artistry in terms of creation, economy of means, innovation, people pushing, you know, storytelling forward, and really kind of recognizing that. And it is also something that I have been so deeply mired in behind the scenes and can speak to. It's an integrity filled process, which is lovely to see. And yeah, I'll, everyone that does our anonymous nominating committees does so entirely because they are fans of film, that they are working in the industry in different capacities, and they donate an enormous amount of time and personal intelligence and experience to creating them. So yes, it is very, it's all of my camp counselor favorite things, but in an awards sort of environment, which is a rarity. And yeah, so I do encourage people, please look through our nominees for the Spirit Awards, because I think it's a great way to discover some really incredible work, both in the feature or first feature, screenplay, first screenplay, all of those, all of the performances. A lot of those are going to be from titles you maybe haven't heard of. They might be from things we spoke about here. Alonzo and Christy, I don't know if you got your eyes on the nominees.
No, because I mean, every year with the Spirit Awards, there is always like a couple of ringers in the big categories where you're like, what? And you know, if you miss them at festivals, it used to be, it would be like, you better join Film Independent if you want to see this movie so you can vote. But at least now you can sort of like make a note of them. And at some point in the next year, they'll be somewhere. They'll be in theaters. They'll be streaming something. But yeah, as always, I think, you know, these nominations are shining a light on movies that in many cases really need the attention.
And I find, too, that, you know, this is my job all year long, as it is for Alonzo. And every single year there are titles where I'm like, oh, I don't know that one. Like, I don't know Upon Entry, which is in your Best First Feature category.
It's in Best First Feature, Best First Screenplay, and it has a performance nod. And it's a film without a distributor. It has not yet come out. It qualified because it played at a festival. And yeah, like Chris, that's a perfect example of a Discovery film that happened to like blow up within our committee. There's another film called Chronicles of a Wandering Saint, which played South by Southwest and hasn't come out. Like, I'm like, oh my gosh, it will change that filmmaker's life. It got a ton of nominations. No one's heard of it. It was just a small film and it's nominated right next to like May, December.
Yeah, that's what's so cool about this is it like, I'm sure it's a huge deal. Even just, it's an honor to be nominated and more, like, you know, just to be in that same breath. And for many years when I was at the AP, I used to do a thing with the Cassavetes nominees, which is now best feature made under $1 million. It used to be under $500,000. And I would do a thing with each of them where I would say, you know, like, how did you do it? What were your secrets? Like, what do you wish you'd known when you started? And among people I talked to were like Kelly Reichert. Mm-hmm. I talked to the Quinceañera guys. And so like the beginnings of the seeds of the long, lengthy career come from places like Film Independent.
Oh, my last thing that I'll add to it, there is an inadvertent entry into one of our favorite things, that the Alonzo tapped the sign category of the importance of physical media and or the worrying future of streaming. And that is one of our nominees for Best New Scripted Series, which is a phenomenal show called Slip, created by and starring Zoe Lister-Jones, which I loved. Oh. It's so much about female identity and sexuality and, you know, discovering self. And it was produced by Roku and is currently available zero places. Ugh. Roku folded. It is this, it's nominated this year. It just came out. It's this exceptional work by an artist, like a very sort of Fleabag kind of 10 episode, one creator's vision. And you currently cannot watch it unless you're a Film Independent member and then you want to watch it to vote. So there you go. All right. Hey, speaking of movies, speaking of movies that this crew can definitely chime in on, moving from nominations to winners, the Los Angeles Film Critics Association has announced its winners for 2023. They named Cannes winner The Zone of Interest as Best Picture. The film also won for Best Director Jonathan Glazer, Best Actor Sandra Hüller, and Best Music. Another noteworthy detail from this year's list of winners is, like the Spirit Awards as well, LAFC no longer separates acting awards by gender. This year, all four of its acting awards, two for Best Actor, two for Best Supporting Actor, went to women. Is this important? Do you care?
Yes.
Oh,
and yes.
Very, 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 very.
Do you care, LA film critics? Currently here.
Yeah, no, this is another, you know, sort of like annual thing, like the Spirit Awards, where, you know, there's on the years that, you know, the years that I've been involved with Spirit Awards, and every year with LAFCA, there's this sort of like cramming of, oh my God, we're going to vote and I got to see these movies. And, you know, we have a very healthy email chain going around that's like, have you seen? Do you know about? And it was really helpful for me this year because that was one of the main reasons that I made it a point to go see Godzilla Minus One, was because other people in the group were like, no, really, you've got to see this. Our runner up in animation was this lovely film called Robot Dreams that Neon is going to release wide in 2024. But it did qualify for this year. It played some animation festivals and had its awards run, I think, in Chicago or something. And again, would have bleeped right over it as a movie that didn't seem like it was going to be on the radar. But I was, you know, people really were like insistent that it be seen. So I hope that, you know, in cases like that, we're getting people interested in movies that are around the corner. Like Zone of Interest opens today in Los Angeles. So, you know, I'm glad that now, and not that anybody has a newspaper ad anymore, but if they did, it would say winner LA Film Critics, you know.
Zone of Interest, which, of course, the actor being recognized from that, Sandra Hüller, starred in Anatomy of a Fall as well, which we discussed on this podcast.
We also honored her for that. The award covers both films. Yeah.
Oh, perfect.
And one thing, too, that we gave to Zone of Interest was what we call our best music/score category,
yes,
which can be the score or it can be the use of music. And so, like, Barbie was the runner-up because that's a score, but it's also
a song score.
I'm Just Ken. Yeah. So, but one of the things that's really cool with Zone of Interest, which folks will hopefully get to experience if they see it in a theater, as they should, is that the soundscape is so vivid and harrowing and haunting, and it's subtle and it's overpowering and it's all of a piece and creating a mood of what it is like in this house, this seemingly lovely house, which just happens to be next door to Auschwitz. And so you hear like gunshots in the background and like the train coming in, and it's really subtle, but you need to, it's all combined with the music. And so I think one thing we do, which is kind of cool, is that we can make room for something like that. So
yeah, we gave a special accommodation within the, we gave the award to Mika Levy, who did the score, but then also had a, included a special accommodation for the sound designer of the film.
Nice. Well, I'm sure that Mikael thanks you.
Mika.
Mika
Levy.
Mika Levy, yeah.
Mika Levy, Mika
Levy.
Right?
Levy. I'm not sure.
Well, listen, there might be somebody named Mikael thanking you as well, but I'm sure Levy/Levy will as well.
I just, I'll tell you, I walk into that meeting every year with one clear thing on my mind that I want to make happen. And this year, that thing was getting a Best Supporting nomination for Rachel McAdams for Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. And doggone it, we did it.
That was fun. Lonzo. Yeah, part of what's fun about voting in the room is like a cool idea will take hold, and as it rolls through the room, it's like, oh, we're gonna do this. Oh, this is gonna happen. And we come up with some really unexpected and inspired nominees that way. Like, I think another one that Alonzo loves is when we pick Tom Hardy for Locke for Best Actor. Like, so we'll do weird out of the box picks like that.
And it annoys Oscar pundits, which is maybe the best part.
What does it mean?
Exactly. Well, that ties it together with the Spirit Awards. So well done. All right. Well, then we're going to, now that we've tied a neat bow on all of that, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we will be discussing Poor Things.
If you're Black, you probably love you some Paramore, huh? Or what about the TV show Golden Girls? Ginger Ale? Daytime television? Don't lie, I know you love at least one of them. I'm Sequoia Holmes, pop culturist and host of Black People Love Paramore. Contrary to the title, it is not a podcast about the band Paramore. Each episode, I, along with a special guest co-host, dissect one pop culture topic that mainstream media doesn't necessarily associate with Black people, but we know we like. Tune in every other Thursday to the podcast that's dedicated to helping Black people feel more seen.
Black People Love Paramore is now on the Maximum Fun Network. Check out the most recent episode featuring Shar Jassel today.
All right, welcome back to Maximum Film. I am your host, Drea Clark. In the studio with me today are...
Christy Lemire.
Alonzo Duraldi.
Now, on September 1st, the Maximum Film group chat, which we've definitely mentioned before because it is hot, 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 got a message from Mr. Alonzo, who was in Venice, and said... Quote, put Poor Things on your list of shit that's absolutely going to blow your mind in 2023. Well, we had to wait longer than originally planned to finally see what the fuss was about. The movie, which stars Emma Stone, Willem Dafoe, Rami Youssef, and Mark Ruffalo, had its release date pushed back due to the actor's strike, but it is rolling out now across the U.S. Alonzo, in addition to knowing that it's going to blow your mind... would you mind giving us a brief synopsis of Poor Things?
Sure. Emma Stone, one of the two winners of Best Lead Performance from LA Film Critics this year, plays Bella Baxter. And at first, she seems to be a quite unusual creature. And as the film proceeds, we come to understand that she is... coming of age, even though she seems to be an already grown woman. Why, you ask? I would rather not say, really. I think it's something that's best discovered when you see the film. But her journey, both literal and metaphorical, takes her on a picaresque a jaunt through fin de siècle feminism and borderline steampunk. And she... comes to understand her power along the way, also her sexuality, also the power of her sexuality and the sexuality of her power, if that makes sense. If it helps, this is written by Tony McNamara, who also wrote The Favorite, which also starred Stone, and also created the Bravo show, the Hulu show, The Great, which covers somewhat similar ground, although not nearly as... utterly bonkers and mind-blowing as this movie is. It is Stone reuniting with favorite director Yorgos Lanthimos, and it is a trip. She's not the only one going on a journey over the course of this thing. And I'm so excited that now finally everybody's getting to see this movie that I decided back in September was probably going to be my favorite of the year. And barring any shocking developments in the weeks to come, still is. Poor things.
Poor things. I think, A, you did a great job of once again flirting with me using your vocabulary. I'm always grateful. Always grateful for your word choices. And two, there is a lot in Poor Things that is this, I think a defining feature of this movie is the idea of discovery, both for her, but also as an audience. And so this is one we always give a little of a sort of, you might get some spoilers in this, but I think we can put our best game faces on for talking around that because the discovery nature of it is kind of delicious. And also a lot of, What then? Who shot who in the what now? It's very, it's all a little bit of a twist. I'll start with Marissa's well-formed question and a very apt place to jump off. Did this movie, we know where it is for Alonzo, but Christy, did it make your list of shit that absolutely blew your mind this year?
Oh, it's my top movie of the year as well, which is so boring. I hate when Alonzo and I agree. I like when we can pick a variety of things to share with the world, and we'll have to compare our top 10 lists soon. But yeah, I mean, I was sort of like primed for this anyway because I love Yorgos Lanthimos. I love The Lobster. I love it all the way back to Dogtooth. I love The Favorite. There's just like this fascinating kind of push-pull within all of his lavish worlds of like people behaving totally inappropriately within these genteel, pristine settings, right? And that tension is so fascinating. And the language in his films is always so like bizarre and direct and also like loquaciously, wonderfully flowery, but mean. Like this has a meanness to it. This is not as mean as The Great or The Favorite. But one thing I love about it though is the language, is the way that her eloquence evolves, right? And everything evolves with her, from the costume design to the cinematography to the score. It all gets more elaborate as she comes more fully into her own. And so the details of that, the way that manifests itself, is endlessly fascinating. You cannot catch it all at one time. This is going to be, I think, a major contender in a lot of categories, and deservedly so, as far as costume design, production design, the score, the cinematography, which is just lush and rich. There are these really cool little interstitials between all the different places mm-hmm. that she goes, and they reminded me of Lars von Trier's Breaking the Waves, those little bitty segments in the middle where it's like a little animated and it's dark and it's haunting and mysterious and wondrous. It reminded me of that quite a bit. And everyone's great in it. Like what she's doing here is so technically precise and so complicated that she has to have you on board from the very beginning for a character, which Alonzo, as you said, was like, wait, what is happening here? Because you don't know. And you're totally rooting for her in every scenario. It's broad and it's big physically, but also just like the language is so specific that she has to master all of that. Mark Ruffalo is hilarious. Like I've never seen Mark Ruffalo be funny. I know he's like kind of funny as the Hulk, but not like this. He's this incredibly charming cad and is increasingly buffoonish figure. I liked Rami Youssef in it quite a bit. It's just a wonderful cast, and it was constantly surprising and just a gorgeous film, which has so much to say about, as you say, Alonzo, like feminine power. You know, it's great.
I like that you introduced the idea of Emma Stone's evolution, because I went into this very blind. I knew nothing about it. I'd never seen the trailer. I think I'd seen a single sort of key art poster and was like, all right, she has black hair. Got it. She can only be playing a goth. That must be what's going on. So, which, as you know, is my favorite way to enter a film, is completely blind. Uh-huh. And because of that, when this starts and you first meet her and you see her, I was like, well, that's interesting. People are so riveted by these choices that she's making. And then as it goes and her evolution kicks in and it is so calibrated with what she's doing and your awareness of where she's coming from and what's leading her along as she is evolving and refining makes it all the more impressive. But I'll also there's something about this beyond the film on a storytelling level that I strangely was like, huh, I wonder, am I going to be the first person who finds similarities between Poor Things and Black Panther? And by that, I mean, I felt like, oh, Emma Stone's character in Poor Things is to women what Wakanda is to Black people. Like, there's an absence of cultural imprint, of a historical knowledge of what being that kind of person and existing in the world. So Wakanda, obviously, you have like an entire nation of people who did not grow up affected by the great harms of colonialism and all of that. Poor Things, you get a similar sort of clean slate. And what that gives you in her character of watching, especially a female character with an absolute void of shame, was refreshing in a way that I was like, oh, that's thrilling. I did not know that's what I really wanted to see, because it's played out for laughs a lot of the time. You know, she's sort of saying these things in a very forthright manner where she does not have the filter of politeness. She does not have all of that. But instead of it just being like, oh, it's a fish out of water, or oh, it's an alien, it's a, oh, let me use this as an example of how not only ridiculous are a lot of sort of the society polish, but how harmful that kind of limitation can be.
I thought you were going to say it was similar to Barbie, Drea. I thought you were gonna, when you said it reminded me of a B. I thought you were going to say Barbie.
You could honestly, you could make a great example for similar trajectories and a similar absence of what that means to be growing up in that world or not.
Totally. She goes off into the world and finds out who she is and like increasingly butts up against the patriarchy and just plows through them. Right. And it has to leave to come back to find that it was in her all along. So it's so much like Barbie in that way, but also with like incredible clothes.
I like that Barbie had too.
Diss on Barbie.
That's why, gotcha.
Yes. Okay. Because like so much of how the Mark Ruffalo character functions as a rake is contingent upon being able to manipulate women in a certain way, and it just doesn't work on her. And he just becomes more and more flummoxed until he is essentially sort of hoisted on his own petard because he has more than met his match in terms of someone that he can't manipulate in the traditional ways, and he has no idea, he has no plan B. There's no other options there.
It's set up so cleanly in, you know, this isn't a movie of a lot of one-liners, but there are certainly a few, and you know, they become lovers, a word that bumps me out, but they become lovers. And she's like, all right, let's go again. And then he's like, oh no, men don't work that way. We take a while. And she's like, oh, a weakness in you, I would say. Like, it's just this idea of, oh, discovering the fundamental flaw in the male design that's somehow always been like, we are the masterful power. Like, there were just a lot of little touches like that. He's
so good.
In that
way, it's also like Wonder Woman, I guess.
Yes. Parallels. I'd love to get into, Christy mentioned some of them, but this is it's an exciting cast. I mean, Emma Stone, as Alonso mentioned, has partnered with both the writer and director before. Mark Ruffalo is an absolute revelation in this, and it's this thing of like, oh my gosh, don't scare him. Get him excited about continuing to work with fun directors, because look at the things that could come out of Mark Ruffalo. But even I saw this with Jen Wilson from Film Independent, and us, we were like, how in the world did Rami Youssef end in this? I didn't even know he wanted to be doing this kind of thing. Like, so if you're anyone that's had to do any casting or any process that, like you get the short lists, you get the things, the idea of just at every step of it, I was like, Christopher Abbott? That one sort of makes sense, but the idea that both Christopher Abbott and Jared Carmichael were in this, and that they were in...
Gerard Carmichael and Hannah Shigula are traveling companions in this movie.
And
entire movie about them and their journeys.
I do not know her, but I would like Hannah... What's her last name?
Hannah Shigula. She starred in a lot of Fassbender films. She's like
Oh, okay.
A European cinema legend of the 70s and 80s.
Well, I would like her to play me in something. That's how much I appreciated her. But the Gerard Carmichael, like you said, I was like, how are both of the leads of On the Count of Three in this random movie?
Oh, good point.
What is happening?
I forgot about that. Like, just, oh, I love that movie.
Right? Just so, there's just so many, there's so many swings and so much that's going on, but the performances that are coaxed out of them and how they're also as particular to the world building here as anything else is, like, a you French, have to get people in the same world.
A French madam played by Catherine Hunter, who played all of the witches in Joel Cohen's, yes, Macbeth.
She's so good.
Yeah, there's a lot of choices going on here, I think, is one way to describe the filmmaking. It is maximalist in a lot of ways in terms of what's going on and how and why. But yeah, like you, Drea, I walked into this movie knowing pretty much nothing, which is always such a treat when you can make it happen. And there were times where I guess I forgot the Lantimos of it all. And so when I would just be laughing at something, and I'm like, oh yeah, right, this is what he does, where he puts you in these incredibly uncomfortable situations and things that are completely relatable and yet completely otherworldly at the same time. And like, you know, lands the zinger, you know?
And yeah, although for all of its weirdness, there's incredible uplift to it. It's incredibly, like, it's a happy, joyful movie in a way, yeah, that most of his films are not, despite the Lanthimos-ness of it all.
True.
And on her journey, each new person she meets, you know, whether it's Gerard Carmichael and Hannah Shigula or whoever else, Catherine Hunter, like, they mold her, but they make her more herself, right? It's not like, mm-hmm, each of them is changing her and she's malleable in ways that are, like, bad or sad. Like, she becomes more of the empowered version of herself that she was always meant to be, and they're sort of like helping her, guide her along the way.
That's fantastic. And the philosophy of that is kind of revelatory, right? The idea, mm-hmm, of as you grow, as you evolve, as you become wiser, that it actually is you getting closer to being your fullest self. Like, that's the life ideal, right?
Not for nothing do they say that every movie since The Wizard of Oz somehow references The Wizard of Oz, and I think you could totally make a case that Bella is the Dorothy here, you know?
Yeah. That's great. Do not show this to children, though.
No.
I've had people ask me, though, about the really graphic sexual content in here, and some people who, other critic friends of ours, who have had a real problem with it, particularly with there's some sex work in it, and I thought that was essential to her journey, you know, that, yeah, she comes into her own in terms of her body. I wasn't offended by it at all, because by the time that happened, she is in an evolved state where, like, it's good.
It's defined by agency, right? Like, every, mm-hmm, time that she's moving forward or having a different sexual experience, it's motivated purely by her own desire to explore and discover. Sorry, Lonzo. Yeah.
No, I was going to say, this movie kind of very rightly, you know, we talk about, oh, sex work is work, but like here, sex work is socialism. You know, she talks about, mm-hmm, how we are our own means of production, you know, and that's great. And that is sort of part of the again, this is about this evolution of this character. And part of her growth is understanding that this is a way to earn money. And that is a way that is also educational for her, because she's trying to understand, you know, the world and people and how they function. And so all of her choices are made with absolute clarity and absolute certainty, and with, as you say, with utter agency. Like, she is always in control of these transactions, and it is a sort of transactional practice for her in a lot of ways. And so, yeah, I think it is very revolutionary that this movie can walk the walk of being like, yes, you know, sex work is not necessarily this like tragic thing where people end up. It can be a thing that people choose to do for themselves for very legitimate reasons, and they give her very legitimate reasons for doing so.
I also think how she's filmed through in the sex scenes throughout is it threads a fine needle, you guys. You're welcome to use that phrase yourself, but it's a walks a tight line. Is that better? That she is, it's very sexual. You do, as Chrissy said, there's a lot of genuine graphic sex. She's naked through a lot of this. You will see more Emma Stone boob than you ever thought you'd see. And yet the camera is not there to try and be provocative or even sensual.
Or leer.
Exactly. So much what if it's ends up almost every time getting closer and closer to her reaction on her face to that moment, to what she's getting, what she is getting out of each sexual encounter. And that is not easily done. Like, the amount of times we've watched sex scenes and you're like, what, why do I, there's, yeah, I know there's a whole thing with our neutered young babies of the world now, the 20 somethings who thinks that there shouldn't be sex scenes in films anymore. But there's something about this, like, they are doing something for the story, but they're also done, oh, this is how you present sex in a way that isn't just lascivious. It's doing a lot of things all at once. There's still some sexy moments in that, for sure. But for me, I never had that, like, oh, do I need to feel bad for this actress? Like, that kind of cringy, internal, just, ugh, reaction.
Yeah, it's not cheesy, nor is it like falsely romantic. You know, it's not like Skinamax.
Right. No, and it is there as a function of the character and not as a way to like titillate the audience, you know. Yeah. Like, and I think there haven't been enough examples of people understanding the difference between those things and how to, I remember when Short Bus came out, you know, and John Cameron Mitchell talked about the idea of like the way that a musical number can tell you what pages and pages of dialogue would tell you about a character and what they want and who they are and what, you know, their existence in the world. A sex scene can do the same thing, but it very rarely gets the opportunity. But I think here it absolutely is part of this woman's awakening. And as you say, she is operating in a space free of shame and sort of patriarchal expectations of how women are supposed to behave and what they're supposed to accomplish.
Hear, hear. Well, with that, we're going to vote it on out with this film. How we vote on this podcast is our very top tier is a screen it, middling is stream it, and the bottom is skip it. It's all right there in the name. It's less how you can see something and more what would you recommend for an audience based on this film. So, Alonzo, do you want to kick us off and show Christy how it is done?
Absolutely. Well, to the surprise of no one, I am totally a screen it. I love that Disney owns this movie now, thanks to their acquisition of Fox and Fox Searchlight. But yeah, this is a glorious experience. See it in the big screen, be enveloped in its beauty and its madness and its wit and its power. And, I this is a movie that is going to, I hope, run roughshod through award season, but it is in no way like an Oscar bait kind of movie.
Nice. Christy.
I'm totally a screen it. I can't imagine seeing it any other way because it's big and beautiful and bold and there's so much to just drink in. But then there are so many wonderful little details from like the bizarre little creatures that exist in this world to just everything that she wears, every puff sleeve extravaganza that she wears. So I think you just, and the score as well is constantly surprising. It changes and it grows. And I think you want to be in the middle of all that. So screen it for sure.
Skip it. Just kidding. Twist. Not. I'm glad Christy brought up the puff sleeves because I had a very Anne of Green Gables reaction to watching this and was like, oh, I need all of the puff sleeves. That's what all the cool girls are wearing. Yeah, I think this is phenomenally special in the actual meaning of the word. And I don't think you're going to be prepared at all for what these visuals of the world building is doing. It's like if Terry Gilliam was painterly and carnal and then 10 times more beautiful and fantastical. It's really kind of...
And understood women.
And understood women. Oh, I mean, just visually. Don't forget, Terry Gilliam could not be making this movie. But yeah, I think it is out there and worth getting your eyeballs on. So there we go. We did it. Poor things. High fives all around. And now we are going to be right back after we hear from another show from Maximum Fun.
Throughout history, sirens have captured men's attention, enticed men with their feminine wiles, and fulfilled men's primal needs. The siren's allure persists.
They have not. Unless the primal need is, I need to be smashed on the rocks.
Yeah, smash me.
Smash me, mommy.
Smash me, mama.
Smash me, mommy.
The siren's allure.
Why do we do this to ourselves?
Strand me, baby. Strand me,
baby.
So, yeah, this is my brother, and me for Maximum Fun on Mondays. It's just like that. Just like that, but more, it's just like that, but more of it. There's just more of that.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I continue to be your host, Drea Clark. In the studio with me are
Alonzo Duraldi
and Christy Lemire.
Today's movie is, in essence, a Frankenstein tale, but the details, mood, and moral of that original monster story have been thrown out the window. Gang, what other monster is due for this kind of treatment, and how would you rewrite the story? Who would star in it? And if you pitch it and I like it, can I have it for free and go make it? I do love this because there's the very clear Frankenstein elements of it, but it really does, as it says here, throw it out the window. Like, it is not a, oh, this is why. It's not even the same metaphor of what you're getting. It's more an exploration of what happens if you sort of combine things.
And it's funny because I think after writing Pygmalion, George Bernard Shaw sort of acknowledged that he was kind of redoing Frankenstein in the play that would become My Fair Lady. So
nice.
these concepts have been grafted together before. Christy, ooh, what are your
pun intended? Grafted, yeah. Pun intended.
Nicely done, right there.
I'll own it, even though I did not mean it. Christy, you got a monster for us?
I do. It's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, but they're both Lindsay Lohan.
Go on.
First off, how dare you? Secondly, how dare you? Yeah.
It's the dark side of the parent trap.
I like that a lot. And I'll say, too, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde already has an addiction angle to it, right? Like, doesn't he, like, take something that, like, unlocks the
oh yeah, there's a potion involved. Yeah,
it's right there. This I'll say as we get, because I definitely want to hear more about that. But one of the elements that this reminds me of, because we've seen a few recent, I mean, there's always, but reimagining of monsters. So shout out to the 2020 Invisible Man with Elizabeth Moss.
That was amazing.
Which is so fantastic and takes very, I mean, it follows the, you know, structure of it, but it's also takes sort of domestic abuse. It takes the idea of hidden victims, all of these things, and it ties it into the sort of storytelling fairy tale thread of the Invisible Man in a way. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, or Ms. Hyde. You're joking, but I'm like, you know what? Lindsay could use that. She could use that launching, Christy.
Well, so here's the thing. So she's back, baby, right? She's making Christmas movies. She was in a Netflix Christmas movie that Alonzo and I, of course, had to talk about on Breakfast All Day. And that's like the cute, you know, comic timing of her. But I feel like the dark Lindsay Lohan of the Canyons is still lurking in there somewhere.
Ooh, yeah.
And with a better script could like tap into her dark side, because she's seen some things, you know. You look back at Mean Girls or Freaky Friday, so fresh faced and just that incredible instinctive comic timing. But I feel like she's a little older now and can play with the dark side that lurks within her and do both very convincingly. So does she try to get her parents back together while Jekyll and Hyde also? Why not? Let's embrace the and here.
Let's get together. Yeah. I know that's the Hayley Mills, but that song should always be. Also,
it is referenced in passing in the Lindsay Lohan Parent Trap.
Oh, thank God. So many of the movies you just described with Lindsay Lohan, I never realized she's always playing duality. Like, she plays two characters in Freaky Friday. She plays two characters in Mean Girls. Like, right. When Katie goes full plastics versus the kind of homeschool girl she is. This is, I'm just building the pitch for us.
That's Kristen. Why Vanessa Hudgens had to play three princesses to really up the game, you know.
She can be, if Lindsay won't attach, then we'll then go to the Hudge.
Oh, also in the Christmas movie, she gets amnesia.
That's
right?
True.
She's
a like a mean bitch.
She's a bitchy heiress, and then she has a skiing accident.
That is so true.
And it hits her head in a tree and becomes a nice person who makes cookies.
Lindsay does not have the time to just play one character. If you're bringing her in, give her at least two. She'll do it even if they have the same name.
I don't get out of bed to play one person.
I feel like you have a think piece in the making here, Drea. The duality of Lindsay Lohan. This is a really smart, thoughtful piece that you should write. Oh, great.
Well, someone else can write it, but I would like to take full credit, if I may.
As a producer does. My thought was, the whole thing with the mummy is like it's a preserved corpse, basically, who like is still ambulatory and wakes up, and I guess their organs are all in jars, and everyone they know is dead, and of course they're sort of like peeved, you know. And I thought, well, there's like two ways you could go with this. First of all, you could do the fish out of water comedy. I was thinking of, weirdly enough, I was thinking about Brendan Fraser because he was in The Mummy, but also he was in Blast from the Past, where he plays the guy who spent his entire life in a bomb shelter with his parents and then emerges in the 90s and doesn't understand how the world works. And so you could do the funny mummy where, you know, they're in contemporary Egypt and like they don't understand discos or cigarettes or taxis or whatever. And for that one, I think you can cast Mina Massoud, who played Aladdin in the Guy Ritchie musical version. Or nice. You could go like full art house, like do the Baylatar mummy, where basically he's really bummed out because, again, everyone he knows is dead and has been for thousands of years, is trapped in a world he doesn't understand, has been stripped of whatever magisterial godlike power he once possessed among the Egyptian people, and really just wants to die permanently. And that version could star Rami Malek.
Ooh, I like that. I also like you're giving us options, so we have something to play with in the room. If like the execs aren't feeling one thing, for you're sure. ready already to shift course.
What
Don't
if?
Don't worry about it. Yeah. Hear me out. Okay. And then you sense it and you're like, okay, let's go to Rami Malek. You know, Academy Award winning Rami Malek. Yeah, it's right there. Locked and loaded.
And he always seems a little sad somehow. There's, you know, when he's not playing Freddie Mercury, like you see him in interviews, he seems a little upset. I don't know. There's he kind of radiates a thing. He never strikes me as somebody I would call happy-go-lucky. And maybe in real life he is. Maybe it's just the cameras turn on and he gets a little like rigid. I don't know what it is. But I sense there's something in him that could play like a really depressed mummy.
Can I tell you a random Rami Malek story?
Please. Yes.
So when I went to the big premiere of the last Twilight movie, Breaking Dawn Part 2, and it was like at downtown LA at like LA Live. It was a huge extravaganza. And after the movie, I'm sitting in my seat and this guy next to me is like, "Hi, I'm an agent. My client is in this movie." I'm like, "Oh, wow, that's so great." He's like, "Yes, this is Rami Malek." And he leans over. He's like, "Hi," and he's like, "He's gonna be a big star someday." I'm like, "Sure, he is." It's your job to say that, but you know, he had the right guy because look at him now. Maybe he got Rami Malek the Freddie Mercury gig. You know,
there you go.
Oh my gosh!
That agent was not afraid to chat up strangers at a premiere.
This is my guy.
That's his guy.
He's gonna hustle, right?
Absolutely.
That is exactly who he wants.
Yes.
He's gonna thank him. That's exactly. We could hear his. We rewind that acceptance speech and hear that guy's name. Okay. So mine is something I would like to see similar to Poor Things in a deeply absurdist way, which you kind of have to by virtue of what it is, and that is. Exiting out of sort of movie monster territory and more into classic literature / Roman and Greek mythology, Medusa, y'all. Ooh. I feel like Medusa needs a reimagining along the lines of the Wicked Witch of the West in Wicked, largely because most people who aren't familiar with it, who don't, you know, don't F with mythology, are just like, oh yeah, she's like the terrible woman with hair made out of snakes who turns people to stone when they look at her. And the reality is, in the stories, the idea Medusa was actually a beautiful young woman who Poseidon had sex with, and with gods that normally means sexually assaulted. And then his wife or partner Athena found out and then punished her by turning her hair into snakes. So this attribute that she has, that she's known for through all time and space, was thrust upon her from some nonsense retribution. And then she, of course, died because she was beheaded by Perseus. I say, of course, like everybody's talking about this at lunch every day. You guys know. You remember how Perseus. And
are you even a friend of Edith Hamilton?
Exactly. But then the only reason she could do that, she was the only mortal of the Gorgons. Like, just all this stuff. So there's just things about that I think, ripe for narrative, playing. There's so many ways you can go. There's also the idea that, like, her blood, where it dropped, like, vipers sprung out of it. So there's you do this to me, you're going to feel it forever. And I'll tell you who I would like to see in that is our girl Zendaya. Because I think that she has a deep performance within her. And I'm not crazy about a lot of the people that she's worked with thus far. So putting her in the hands of someone who can pull out performance like our buddy Yorgos or like so many talented directors would be very, very fun, I think.
That's a really cool idea.
I like the idea of Medusa being like somebody who is so powerful that it's in her rider that no one is allowed to look at her. You know? So
Yes.
And that's her way around, like, the whole turning people into stone thing.
Yeah. and it's again, there's something poignant about that of like, ugh, can you believe this bee won't let us look at her? And you're like, yeah, man, you should believe that bee. You don't want to look at her.
It's for your own good, I swear.
Exactly.
Her day job is she's a sunglasses model.
Ooh.
That's how she gets through life.
Single-handedly bringing back the Ray-Bans. She's the Anna Wintour of the 2000s.
No. She's Sia.
Oh, nice! She's got... Actually, you can believe... Sia's head is big enough to cover hair made of snakes. Or her wig is. I like it. I like all of it. All right. I think we did a great job. If you have other ideas, please leave them on our Facebook page. I enjoy reading those. Generally in an untimely manner because I'm a nana with social media, but I always get to them and I love them a lot. Something else I always get to and I sure love a lot is this time of year when our own sweet Christmas Zaddy has things punched up to high gear. It is December. It's happening. And we are going to dig into our Christmas Movie Minute, where one Alonzo Duralde has given 60 hot seconds to tell us all the holiday movies he's seen in the past week. It will be as absurd as Poor Things, how many he has seen. Alonzo, are you ready?
I am.
Oh my gosh.
All right, kicking off with an Anato Royal Christmas on Hallmark. Fun premise and appealing leads, but it doesn't really work the way you want it to. Silent Night, it's great that John Woo is back, but wow, is this movie racist? Like, one white guy kills all of the face-tattooed Latinos in Los Angeles. It was, ouch. Anyway, Christmas in Notting Hill, another Hallmark movie, better than you would expect it would be, and has some fun stuff with the whole sort of US-UK divisions and how that works in a relationship. Catch Me If You Claws with the very charming Eric McCormick. The very charming Luke McFarlane. Sorry, I'm getting all of my Irish people messed up when I'm going this fast. Anyway, he plays a trainee Santa Claus. It's the same plot as Dashing Through the Snow, but a million times better, believe it or not. There's Something in the Barn, fun comedy horror movie with Martin Starr, family in Norway dealing with Something in the Barn. And our Christmas mural seemed like it was going to be the most boring idea ever, but actually has some grown-up conversations and nice romance.
Nice. You did it.
My apologies to Luke McFarlane for calling you Eric McCormick. That was just the name that came out. And when I have 60 seconds, I'm operating under the worst kind of pressure.
He's the guy.
Yeah. But I hope that you turn Luke McFarlane, Eric McCormick, into the new Dermot Mulroney.
It could be. I mean, like, Luke McFarlane's voice is in the intro of this show every week. Dermot Mulroney and Dylan McDermott.
Thank you. That's what I'm hoping for. If you enjoyed that, and I bet you did, a reminder, you can ask yourself what my friend Kiva asked me over text this week, which was, I want to get one of my daughters, who are teenagers, one of Alonzo's books for Christmas, because he, of course, wrote I'll Be Home for Christmas Movies in the whole mix, and Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas, both available. And I said, you should get both. Why are you asking me which one? Get both. How dare
Thank
you?
Thank you, my friend.
Yes. All right.
You should be my agent.
Yeah. I could be the person thrusting you upon Chrissy Lemire at future excursions. I can't wait. We've rounded the bend. We are here at the end of the old podcast, which means we are in staff pick territory. It is time for us to recommend whatever we would like from the whole world of cinema. Staff picks. Who has a movie they would like to start with?
Is it, wait, can I pick a TV show? Does it have to be a movie?
Girl, live on the edge.
Okay. I thought I could pick a TV show. I just watched the most recent episode of The Gilded Age, and a lot happens. I won't say in case you haven't watched it, but this whole season is nutty, and the hats get incrementally a little bit bigger each time. Like, more feathers, more flowers. It's a fun game I like to play. Like, how insane will their hats be? But then major dramatic things happen. This is more of a soap opera this time around than ever before. So you can catch up with all of The Gilded Age, the second season of The Gilded Age. Go back and watch season one. You've got Christine Baranski versus Carrie Coon. What more do you want? These delightful divas going at it in turn of the century New York. So Gilded Age.
If you miss Downton Abbey, it is as close as we're getting right now, thanks to Julian Fellows. And Christine Baranski is giving the best Maggie Smith she's got, so it's worth it.
It's on HBO Max or Max, whatever it's called these days.
Mine is also on Max and on the Criterion Channel. I was going to recommend Godzilla Minus One, which you should totally go see. But now Dre has reminded me that I should recommend The Marriage of Maria Braun, starring Hannah Shigula, one of the best films of the 1970s, directed by the great Rainer Werner Fassbinder. And it is also about a woman making her way through the world and being very unapologetic about what she wants and how she's going to get what she needs to have to get along with, you know, in this culture. And, you know, yeah, it is not tonally in any way like Poor Things, but it is very much a powerful feminist statement and just a great movie that you should see.
All right, putting it on the list. Obviously, I need to see the woman who's going to play me in some things from the 70s. Okay, my pick, I'm not going to lie, I'm a little horrified to admit, is also on HBO Max right now. And you can rent it, but it ties in. I think it would be a nice companion piece with Poor Things if you'd really like to mess with your brain. And a little nod to the zone of interest. In fact, that is Jonathan Glazer's Under the Skin. Another film in the sort of strange, absurdist, dark sci-fi centered around a woman kind of learning about herself with some deep and sometimes unsettling sexuality in it. Under the Skin, yeah, one could say it's not as funny as Poor Things. One could probably easily
say that. The outfits aren't quite as great, but...
Yes, yes. But I do think it's movie making. It is a movie that's been made, and it's it'll stick with you. You'll think about it a lot, and I don't think enough people ever sort of dug into that. So,
Scarlett Johansson's awesome in that movie.
I mean, yeah. She truly is. She really is. All right, we did it. You know who we did it with? Christy Lemire. Yay! Thank you for being here.
Thank you guys so much. It was so fun.
Where can people find you? Listen to you? Read you?
Well, there's a little thing called Breakfast All Day that Alonzo and I do. We have a YouTube channel and a podcast of our own. You can find that in all the places. We do movie news and reviews every Tuesday and Friday. I just relaunched my website, ChristyLemire.com, where you can subscribe to my newsletter. I started a newsletter. Have you heard of these things, you guys? They're really fun. They show up in your inbox every once in a while, and they're chock full of information. I'm the first one to ever write one. I'm a pioneer. So that is there for you. And I also write for RogerEbert.com, and I do both of the NPR shows here about film in Los Angeles. So I have 6 jobs and no job, as so many of us in this business do.
Hear, hear. Chris, I'm a big fan. Christy and Alonzo have beautiful chemistry, which is, you know, permanently heartbreaking to me as the newer blonde co-host in his life. But it is a true delight to listen to you guys all the time and or watch you. Do check them out and check out all of Christy's other stuff, including her new art form that she's just invented, the newsletter.
People are very excited.
We're all very excited. I hope that takes off. Alonzo, thank you for another wonderful show, your beautiful beard, and your vocabulary. Thank you. If you listeners have a comment or a suggestion about this week's show, send us an email at MaximumFilm@MaximumFun.org or find us on any of our social media channels. All those links are in the show notes. Next week, we are going to be talking about a little film called Love Actually. Our producer is Marissa Flaxbart. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun.
Maximum Fun, a worker-owned network
of artist-owned shows,
supported
directly
by you.